Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Barbara Kennedy. Barbara is a money trader turned therapist turned author. She wrote the first baby boomer memoir, Hurrah's Nest, Memoirs of a Money Trader, in the house in Connecticut that Catherine Ann Porter wrote Ship of Fools. She learned this soon afterwards, but it took her 40 years to publish. Barbara, why did it take 40 years?
It took a while to really understand the book. Because I write narratives, they're written actually from the time that one is reflecting on one's life and they understand the meaning of their life. They understand what this did in their world. And so when I started writing the book 40 years ago, it was the time when soap operas were big. And so I started to write it as a soap opera until it got legs. Now, the fact that I wrote the first draft of the book in the same house that Catherine Ann Porter wrote Ship of Fools in was, if there's such a thing as a coincidence, I mean, what kind of a coincidence is that in my world?
Yeah.
It was years later when I realized I was a copywriter, so it's not like words were foreign to me. I was a copywriter at the time, and I worked on Madison Avenue, and it was 1971. And it didn't even occur to me to write a novel, so I was visiting a friend of mine who was my very first mentor. Her name was Rose Van Sand, and she was 80 and I was 20. And she was married to a man who was Danish, and he ran the one and only Danish newspaper in New York City. Now, you had to have lived as long as I have lived, and I'm 60, to really appreciate how this all came about, because Rose Van Sand and I developed the first mannequins, window mannequins, that had nipples, if you can believe it.
Really?
And she and I, we were fired. Well, we went to Chicago to the Niedermeyer factory, and they were just coming out with these new mannequins. And she was the display director at Lerner Shops, and I was their fashion coordinator at the time. Now, Lerner's was owned by Mishula Merklis, who is the CEO. You remember him? He's married to Isadora.
Yes.
And he headed up a Rapid American. They owned Schenley and a lot of liquor companies, but then he bought the Lerner stores. And we had 650 stores to coordinate, and they did no advertising. They just did mannequins. And so when the Niedermeyers showed us these new mannequins, Rose, who's 80, and me, and I'm 20, we look at each other like, oh, we're going to get fired. But we ordered two, and we brought them back to New York, and it was a time when skinny tees came out. There were tiny, tiny little ribs, and they showed everything. And so we used these two mannequins in the Fifth Avenue store. There were taxi cab crashes. I mean, it created mayhem on Fifth Avenue, which was the good news, bad news. Okay, that was pretty good. But, of course, Rose and I got fired, so we went over to the 21 Club, and we drank martinis at 10:30 in the morning until Howard Lane, who was the president of the company, called us and rehired us, but we had to get rid of the mannequins. Okay, so the irony of that is that Lerner Shops and Victoria's Secret, they got into bed together 30 years later. And here I am, I no longer live in Manhattan, and I'm walking down Madison Avenue, and I pass Victoria's Secret on the corner, and I back up, and there are the mannequins.
With nipples.
I mean, those were the mannequins from 30 years ago. So they must have been found in a warehouse someplace.
Oh,
but there was such a finish on them. They were opalesque. And I would know them in my sleep. I just stood there at the window and gasped. So millions of things, little things like this. The world has very changed today.
Mm-hmm.
But there were certain steps that took us from here to there. And when you start looking at how companies have merged, and you say to me, why did it take you 40 years? I didn't even understand the story I was writing until 35 years later. That's when I had, at that point, I hadn't even gone to Wall Street, and it was a Wall Street story, but I was writing the story from the perspective that I was the wife, and I was married to a Wall Street type guy. So when I wrote the first draft, his dialogue was all blank because I didn't know really what she was asking him, and I didn't know really what he was going to respond, how he was going to respond, and the actual language that traders use in everyday life. What I wrote about hadn't even happened yet.
Wow.
So I had created a scaffolding. I want to say that I wrote the book, but I know it sounds a little weird for me to say Catherine Ann Porter had a stake in it. I can't say that for sure. I just don't know how I conceived this book 40 years ago. Then I went to Wall Street, and the book began to unfold for me. So the 25 years that I spent, half of it in the World Trade Center, hadn't even happened yet. So as I was a trader, a fixed income trader, things were happening, and I kept saying, and I was taking notes. Oh, my God, that's what she said. Oh, isn't that what he would respond to that question? Isn't that how he would say it? But it was really all coming out of me because I was the actual trader. It wasn't the husband in the book. Then what happened was there was another piece that was missing, and it was the psychological piece. And I hadn't even gone to graduate school yet. So I took a hiatus, and I went to New York Medical College in the School of Health Programs, the Health Sciences Division, and I learned about behavior. And as if that wasn't enough, then I went and got another master's degree in clinical work so that I could understand the real behavior, how it actualizes itself in everyday life. And I'm talking about aberrant behavior. And then I was able to write about the third character in the book. So I went in as one of the characters. Then I went to Wall Street so that I could be another one of the characters. And then I became a clinician in the psychological community. I'm a psychoeducator to understand the language and the issues with the third character. And then I could write the narrative cognitively and cogently so that it made sense. No one from the Wall Street community would say, well, that never happened, or that's not the way that works. Do you know how when they have experts on the sets of programs that are about police work or hospital work, and there's always somebody who's a consultant, and somebody who is in that business says, oh, that would never happen, or that would never happen, oh, he would never say that. You know, it just doesn't ring true. It doesn't resonate. Well, you can't really say that about Haraz Nath, because I was actually the characters at some point in the book speaking narratively. This is what I think. This is what I feel. This is what I said. This is why I said it. And so for me, oh, for heaven's sake, it took 40 years to actually make sense of it. And it's only 100,000 words, but it took that long. And then it really developed into a series. So this is the first of a series of 8 to 10 books that are first-person narratives that take place along the baby boomer continuum.
Wow, now, what a story.
Yeah. So it's delicious.
It is delicious. What a great story. I've never heard of anybody, you know, putting it in that perspective, but my goodness, it makes so much sense. Now, you mentioned that, you know, you're part of this. So, of course, this is rated as a fiction book, but really, how much truth is there in this, in Haraz Nath?
Well, there's quite a bit of truth in it. When I wrote my very first book, is called Second Chance Ranch, and that is biographical. And I found that I was able to speak more freely if I fictionalized it. I was able to bring some points in that didn't directly connect to me. And so, even though these are baby boomer memoirs, and when I write fiction, they really are fictionalized memoirs. Of Haraz Nath, I would probably have to say 80% of it is true. is real.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a lot of educating that goes into writing my books. In other words, if you were on a desk, on a trading desk, on Wall Street or in any of the money-centered big cities, you know, Chicago, L.A., and you were actually trading, this would resound for you. But it's even more than that. The characters, I'm a relationship therapist, and the characters relate in such a way that the dialogue rings true. And there are some cases when the dialogues are true, they actually did happen, because you can't write fabulous dialogue. It is what it is. There are lots of writers who view their lives as just a series of copy. Everything is copy. And so you can have a conversation with them and they're constantly scribbling down what you're saying because they can't recreate what you're saying with the same words and the same passion. And really pausing when you pause, it really is very much telling. And so I spend a lot of time really laboring over dialogue, and I record dialogue. When I hear fabulous dialogue, I record it. When people say to me, well, I needed to read your book with a dictionary, I start to laugh because, that, first of all, that's a good thing, and I'm not really sure that they're complimenting me when they say that. But you can't read, for example, Joyce Carol Oates unless you have a dictionary. And when you're done reading any one of her books, you've just expanded your vocabulary by, I don't know, 30 to 100 words. And how is that a bad thing? And because I'm an avid reader, which you are as well, you do have a vocabulary beyond, you know, normal, because you try to find words that will, you know, cut wire. You know, I want you to know exactly the way I felt. So I'm not going to say that I felt tired. Everybody knows that word. I'm going to tell you that I felt depleted after a day. Now, depleted means flattened out. It's different than tired. You know, you're depleted because you've given so much of yourself. You can be tired just because you didn't sleep well. So, you know, you try to find the word that will say it really succinctly, and then you can cut that sentence by 4 or 5 or 10 words.
And that's really creative wordsmithing, and I know that that's something that you're really good at. So now, speaking of terms, you used Hurrah's Nest as the title of your book. Now, you know, this is sort of a term that really, I believe, came up about late 19th century or early 19th century, and really is not used anymore, but you brought that in to today's world. And so I'm curious as to why did you choose Hurrah's Nest?
Well, it shows me. I have tried to change the title numerous times, and it's like trying to change the name of a major character. You know, the name and the character become one. When I started writing the book, it was very not known. There are a couple of books that I, and this is news to me, and this is since Amazon, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing the book, there was not an Amazon. You can see that it has been used in literature before. Mine's the newest one. I don't know where it came from. It means really a rat's nest.
Right.
It just means everything is so. People have said to me after reading the book, then I got to the end and I cannot believe that you actually knotted every single thread. I mean, you are truly a tapestry artist. Oh, I'll take that any day of the week. But the story actually begins at the turn of the century in Italy. And it really is, it's so interwoven because it's a story of two sisters from the turn of the century. And one of them is married to a very successful man, and the other one is just kind of drifting. And this family legacy continues along until one of the characters says, I'm not going to give this legs. I'm not going to give this family drama legs. I'm going to take it with me to the grave. Well, do you really have the power to do that? I mean, can you change destiny?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's scary. But in the middle of all of this, what's going on with these two women, because everybody in the book is trying to figure out what's going on with these two women, there's a whole thing going on Wall Street. It's kind of smoke and mirrors. And once you read the book, and it really talks about when one of the characters, Becky, there are three characters. There's Becky, there's Meg, and then there's Alex. And you begin to wonder why these three characters are so important, but you do find out in the end. Because it's a book about, it's a story about deception. What's real and what's really real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The story does tell you about what went on in the financial markets in the 80s to change the scaffolding of our financial markets and the banking industry. And really our relationship with our international trading friends, other countries. And when it all came apart in the 80s and we had to bail out countries that we had lent opaque money to, in other words, we got so much money from selling oil, from OPEC raising the price of oil. Oil could only be paid for in U.S. dollars. So other countries had to buy the dollar. That's why the dollar, the U.S. dollar, was so strong in the 80s. Other countries had to pay for oil in U.S. dollars. Those dollars then got put on deposit in New York City banks, like Chase Manhattan and Citibank and Morgan, you know, all the big banks. Now, what were these banks going to do with billions of dollars on deposit? Well, other countries like Mexico and other countries in South America, they came in to borrow the money so that they could rebuild their infrastructure. And then the price of oil collapsed. Well, they had natural resources as their collateral for these loans. And with the prices collapsing, they could no longer repay these loans, billions of dollars. And so the U.S., you and I, had to bail out these other countries because we still owe that money back to OPEC. You see, the financial markets are so twisted, I hate to tell you this, because no one else is going to really share this with you, that I was there and I watched it all happen. And when money was stolen from the Vatican Bank, $3 billion disappeared from Banco de Ambrosiano. These were traders that we knew in Europe, and that money came to New York and then disappeared. And so other than a little article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, all of this mischief went unreported. But you can't do this forever. At some point, you're going to get slapped down. But, you know, everything happens so quickly that people don't reflect back to historically when the financial markets, when we went off the gold system, when OPEC got its legs. Everyone forgets why the world has tightened the way it has and why money has gotten tight and where money has gone, okay, and what inflation is about and what natural resources are and how the political scene affects everything you put in your mouth, because you have to pay for everything that you buy to put in your mouth, and how it's really the foundation, because the 80s, the late 70s through the 80s into early 90s was when all the change took place that we are starting to see now globally. And they were little mistakes, but you know, just like a pebble can cause an avalanche if it rolls long enough, you know, unnoticed, it's kind of what's happening now. So I make sure that when I write books, especially this Baby Boomer series, of which there are 8 to 10, I have an idea for 2 more, what I'm doing is I'm teaching as a result. And so one of the reviewers said it's got it all, sex and murder and, you know, theft and lying and cheating and, you know, it has everything, absolutely everything to keep you rolling. Do you have to be a baby boomer? No, but we have a certain language that we use. We actually complete our sentences, unlike new writers. Now, I write in the stream of consciousness, so sometimes I'll have a sentence that's a word, but it doesn't fit except as a word. So there's some visual engineering that goes on in creating my books as well. I want them to just be a delight for every sense. I want the eye to be happy. I want the ear to resonate. I want When I talk about colors, think about an evening gown in creme de coco. You know exactly what color that is, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but suddenly, oh wow, that's a delicious color. I want it to just be delicious. I want a delicious book. Is it a fluff book? It's not a fluff book. So don't read it for fluff. But if you like fluff, there's enough fashion in it. Okay, she's wearing a beautiful Chanel suit that you don't fully appreciate it until you see the weaving up close. There's enough of that. It's feminine. Is it a chick book? As many men have read it as women, because in the 80s, there were more men on Wall Street working in the financial industry than there were women. And I was very gifted. I was honored to be invited to trade. I mean, I was in the thick of it when I was hired as a Euro-dollar interbank arbitrageur. I had no idea how many words that was. I was so right-brained my whole life. I designed and manufactured children's wear. I was a writer and a fashion coordinator. I didn't really have a developed left brain. When they told me I had to trade in fractions, I almost froze. But then I went back and I learned what you divide into what to get what, and then I was off and running. So developing the left side of my head actually allowed me in time to engineer this series of books. And the books do reflect like social narrative. If you were there, there are no surprises. You remember everything that I'm talking about. In the second book that's coming out, just an aside for a second, the next book that's coming out is called Chelsea Matinee, and if you're from New York, you know the Chelsea section of Manhattan, and it's memoirs of an easy woman. And it's about a woman who is a painter. She's an artist. I am a painter. I'm an artist. So when I talk about mixing colors, I'm not swiping it from a painting book from 1964. I'm actually telling you how I mix my colors and how I apply the colors. So that's the realistic part. No one can challenge that who paints. But what I talk about is how feminist art took root in New York City in the 70s. Is the story about feminist art? No. It's about a woman who paints. But when she comes to New York and starts to describe what she found when she came to New York, you have a sense of being there, as I was. You have a sense of being there, and you learn how feminist art took root and how outsider art, which is the marriage of art and craft, how that came to be. Is that what the story's about? No. Do you walk away from the book knowing more about art, modern art, and feminist art than you ever did before? Yes, because it's real. It talks about the real artists. When Truman Capote saw a photograph of something that he didn't understand, he sat there and he kind of twisted his head up and down trying to understand what angle he's supposed to look at that piece of art at. I mean, that really happened. So you're there. It's a memoir, but it's a narrative, and it's woven with all kinds of interesting things. One of the most important things about that book, the second book, is that a woman moves from Wisconsin, where she grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and she goes to Chicago to paint, and she doesn't really find it. She's still in the Midwest. It's not encouraging her. There's no muse in Chicago for her. So she comes to New York, and she meets two men. And I love to write in threes because there's so much chase. There's a lot of action because there's chase in threes. There's magic in threes. And so she meets two men, and they're two men that she never, ever would have met in Wisconsin in the 60s. One is Italian, and it alludes to the fact that he's mafia, but he's a wise guy. She meets a wise guy, and she meets a black photographer, an African-American photographer, who was given an opportunity to go to school by Mayor LaGuardia. And so now you get some history of New York City, and you get some history of the art museums and the art galleries in New York City, and how all of this art is marketed. and you go down to Soho, and you see Soho while it was yet unsung, as it wasn't yet, as we traditionally think of it, Soho, and you are there just when all of this stuff is starting to happen. Well, this woman is also having an epiphany because she's coming to life and she's growing into a woman. And she tells the story of obsession from 60 years old. She's 60 now, thinking about what life was like when she was in her 20s and when she first met these two men and how these two men changed her life and changed her as the woman she is today. Now, these are two real people in my life, but from the 70s. And it's extraordinary because you can see prejudice. You can see the new generation coming in, the character in the 70s, and she doesn't have the prejudices that the generation before did. For example, the African-American photographer beats her at chess, and her internal dialogue says, what would my father, who owns the hardware store in Wisconsin, say about this? Well, the reader knows exactly what she's saying, but she's saying it coming from a sense of shame almost. But the world has changed, and I have actually spoken to that person 40 years later recently, and we talked about prejudice, and we talked about it's a different time now, and how did we ever survive that? I mean, it's extraordinary. I write about my life, but I fictionalize it. There's a lot to write about. I'm a social worker. One of my books, one of, like, number four of the Baby Boomer memoirs, takes place on what would be the El Paso border to Mexico, Juarez, where hundreds of women have disappeared and been murdered. And she speaks first person about what it's like to work on the border and to work with the Mexican wives who have been left here after their husbands' work visas have expired and they've gone back to Mexico. Who takes care of the women who are very often with children, you know, or pregnant at the time? And how do you manage in situation? Well, you have to go down to El Paso and spend time on the border and talk to people, talk to everybody. And then the story just comes. It just comes.
Wow. I'm sitting here listening to you, Barbara, and you are one prolific writer. And I know that our listeners are just probably mesmerized by all the things that you're saying here and, you know, about the book that you have just written and the upcoming books. And at this point, I'd like you to tell our readers and listeners what your website address is.
My website address is www.madisonave, which is short for Avenue, publishers.com. If you go to Amazon, all the books are available on Amazon. This is actually my fourth/fifth book. Number five is being downloaded imminently, but it's not fiction. I do a lot of nonfiction as well. Amazon creates for you now, for authors who are prolific, your own page. So if you go to Hirah's Nest and you pull up the page, you will see my name is in a different color. If you click on my name, it will bring you to a page that has all of my books on it. So there are four books now listed on Amazon. One of them is nonfiction. That is the very infamous Baby Boomer Men Looking for Love that I wrote 2 years ago, which was a tremendous seller. It's a baby boomer woman talking to baby boomer men about dating, being single in middle age. Some of the rules have changed. Some of the rules have stayed the same. And it was very well received. And as a result of that book, I wrote another book that's called Brainiacs. And this is for high-risk learners, late teens to early adults. You must be a reader. But this is a book that fills in. It's your worksheets, and it fills in everything that you might have missed in your formative training that has stopped you from moving forward. Now, what does that exactly mean? I got the mumps, and I got chicken pox, and I think I got the German measles in third grade, one on top of another, and I missed about 6 weeks of school. It was third grade. What were we learning in third grade? We were learning fractions. I never caught up until 20 years later when I was a Wall Street trader and I was trading government bonds by 1/32nd of 1 point. I had to ramp up and learn how to do that all over again. And so I wrote a book that asks very interesting questions. It's an open book, like what are the colors of the rainbow? I mean, that's something that we learned in grammar school. You'd be surprised how many people don't know the colors of the rainbow, which means they miss a lot of what they look at. If you ask a lot of people, and try it, I'm speaking to your listeners as well as to you, ask people, what color do you get when you mix blue and yellow? 50% of the time, you'll get a blank stare. It's so obvious, but you're missing actually the prisms and perspectives of color. And once you understand that you are missing things, there are things in your blind spot, you begin to wonder, what else are you missing? Do you ever learn a new word, Irene? Today you learn a new word, and then tomorrow you read the newspaper and you see it 5 times, and you wonder, did I just skip over it when I saw it before? Or is this reinforcing that this is a good word and I should really keep this word in my vocabulary? What are we missing? What's in our blind spot? And so I wrote the book based on an internship that I did in one of my master's degrees programs where I was in a residential treatment center for adolescent girls. And I could not believe how much they had missed in chef education. And I would start asking them questions. And some of them missed a year or two of school because there was an illness in the family or they didn't have the money or they were transported to grandma's or, you know, all kinds of bizarre reasons, and they lost the footing of their education. So when you ask them a question like, you're supposed to be home at 3 and you walk in the door at 5, how many hours are you late? They can't, in their head, do the matrix. But when they're done doing these 24 lessons, they can do it all in their head because I diffuse it for them. It's not scary. You can use your fingers. But eventually, conceptually, you won't need to use your fingers because it's not mathematics. It's not calculus. This is basic arithmetic. And so I take the fear out of it, which is what I do as a psychoeducator.
God.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Barbara, thank you so much. I know that our listeners, if they're interested, certainly can look you up on Amazon, as you had mentioned. All your books are there. Your website is madisonavpublishers.com.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners, we're talking right now to Barbara Kennedy. Her book, the newest book that she has published and is out now, is Hurrah's Nest, Memoirs of the Money Trader. Thank you so much, Barbara, for this interview. And this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.